a funeral for net neutrality, how Minecraft led to the Mirai botnet, and an accessibility expert talks to us about the biggest successes in inclusion tech this year. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 10, recorded Thursday, December 14th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Grammarly. Download Grammarly, the intelligent writing app, for free by visiting getgrammarly.com/twit.
And by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. It's good to be back, Megan.
Yes, it is good to be back weekly. I like weekly because we get to delve into the news.
Yeah, I get to spend a little bit of extra time, especially when things break. Well, I would imagine this first story is considered breaking news as of this morning. Breaking the internet news.
It's not stale yet.
Breaking the internet news, is that what it qualifies as? This morning, the FCC held a long-awaited vote on whether to officially abandon net neutrality regulations that would help to keep it involved in protecting the open internet. As expected, under the leadership of FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, the vote split 3-2 across party lines, resulting in the official gutting of net neutrality protections. And joining us to discuss this news is Ernesto Falcon from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome, Ernesto.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to join us. So the EFF Twitter account, I noticed, called this decision one of the biggest mistakes in internet policy history, which is a very big statement to put out there. Explain the EFF's stance on this issue and what this decision by the FCC could potentially lead to. What are people worried about with this?
Well, it is the biggest mistake in its history because it reverses what's been decades of work by the FCC to protect an open internet, both under Republican and Democratic commissioners and chairs in the past. This is the first time and in a market right now that's very concentrated, where a lot of people only have one choice, where the federal regulator is saying, I think it'll just work out and let's just watch it and abandon all the legal tools it has to protect consumers and competition and privacy and kind of all the like. This is it's pretty drastic. So I think what people should be ready for is the ISPs are now very free to exert their power in whatever way they choose. There really isn't any law that restrains them. Some people will point to antitrust law, but the problem is the Supreme Court has said that the expert agencies should be the ones that handle disputes amongst companies when it comes to antitrust matters before you get to antitrust law. So, you know, if I sued Comcast under an antitrust claim or the Department of Justice tried to, the courts would likely kick those claims out and point to the FCC and says they're the ones in charge of that. Not, you know, we're not going to have antitrust law play a role when there's supposed to be an expert agency in charge of this. So it's pretty dramatic in kind of what's to come in the coming months and years on this.
So what do you say to people who insist that we're actually just returning to the status quo? I mean, a lot of people are saying that, even people that may be on the FCC. What do you say to that? Like, this is just going back to the way it was.
Well, it's incorrect as a factual legal matter. And I'll tell you why it's incorrect. As of 2005, when the FCC began to reclassify broadband companies as what are called Title I information services, what they did today, back then, they always thought they had the power to address discriminatory conduct by ISPs and violations of privacy under a theory called ancillary jurisdiction, meaning we have this core power to protect the networks on behalf of the public. And related to that, we can extend that power in other areas that involve communications platforms. Comcast, when they sued the FCC under the BitTorrent issue, when Comcast was throttling BitTorrent and won, really kind of undermined that legal theory. And then Verizon came in after 2010 and pretty much put a nail in the coffin. So the argument of we're just returning back to what the status quo is would have to ignore all the court decisions that have really curtailed the FCC power to do anything about what are called information services under Title I.
Right. Now, Ajit Pai had stated at one point very recently that we're all going to wake up tomorrow after this decision, realize that nothing has changed. But this isn't really about flipping a switch, right? And I should also point out that Ajit Pai, I think it was yesterday, published a video that really just went in the direction of kind of mocking people who would say that this is a bad decision. And I don't know. Did his attempts at humor, does that land flatly when you're talking about the major changes that are happening here?
I mean, it was so poorly timed. I think 12 months ago, you know, you can make light of these issues, but now we're actually seeing exactly what the agency is doing, and it's dramatic, and it's really empowering the agenda, and it's purely empowering the agenda of Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and there's no joke. I mean, there's no laughing matter about this anymore, and the idea that you can do all these different things, while that may be true for the next 12 hours, 24 hours, I'm more worried about the coming years when the kind of the contracts that have been negotiated by like Netflix with Comcast and other big companies, when those start expiring and they have to go back to the negotiation table, and now the ISP no longer has laws that restrain what they can do to an edge provider but doesn't comply or doesn't agree with what they would like to pay. There's a lot they can do to any sort of internet company out there, and there's nothing that the federal government is really putting in the place to prevent that. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, Facebook, Google, and Netflix and the big companies probably okay because they can afford to pay the extra fees they shouldn't have to pay, but they're going to have to pay it arbitrarily. But it's the startup community that I worry about the most. That they don't have the money at hand to compete in some sort of pay to play internet world. I mean, they all depend on an open internet to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've gotten all the bad news out of the way. What about the good news? You say that the Congress can reverse the FCC in 2018. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit.
Certainly. So Congress can actually invoke what's called the Congressional Review Act. It's a process to repeal a decision by a regulator. The Trump administration used a lot of these at the beginning of this year to repeal a lot of the final regulatory decisions of the FCC and other federal agencies did at the end of the Obama years. And so it's interesting in that it can force a vote in the United States Congress, despite the fact that the Republicans control both branches. And you have about 80%+ of the American public opposed to what this FCC is doing. So, you know, I would always put stock in the political process working out. I mean, you cannot, you know, this is something I tell the kind of the ISP industry is I do not understand how you think you can sustain your policy agenda without the blessing of the American people. If 8 out of 10 or more and 7 out of 10 conservatives think you are doing harm and that you are wrong, why do you think the political process won't eventually bite back? And I think the 2018 year will be a very, very powerful year of people fighting to respond, both in the courts, at the states. A number of states are going to introduce net neutrality type bills and in Congress.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the local municipalities, because I don't know if I'm confused on this point or just don't have enough information. But I mean, there are a lot of local municipalities who are saying, well, we're going to implement something on our own. But doesn't that go counter to what Ajit Pai has presented here for being even possible, that the federal kind of over whatever trumps what's happening on the local level?
Sure. So the issue is called preemption. Can the federal preemption and you know, issues of kind of what's the reach of the federal regulator against any sort of state involvement. There's a couple of major problems with what the FCC is asserting here. The ironic thing is by eliminating all of the federal law that really applies to ISPs, they're eliminating their power to say no to what states want to do. The states are actually more powerful now than they've ever been in terms of what they can do with communications providers. The restraint on state power will be when it hits across the state lines, what's called interstate commerce. And that's just from the Constitution. The states are not allowed to regulate interstate commerce, but they're certainly allowed to regulate what happens in their own backyard. And they've always had that power. And so, you know, I think franchise agreements, a lot of cities are going to look at their franchise agreements with cable and telephone. Cities that are providing their own broadband platforms, like municipal broadband, can just on their own decide they're going to operate in a neutral manner, which would be a positive step. And I think a number of the cities that do provide internet service will do that. The limitation of the cities at the end of the day, though, is they cannot fully restore net neutrality, because at the end of the day, you do need the interstate power of the federal agency.
So trust in the political process. What else can we do if we want to change this? What are some things that regular, normal people can do?
So I think contacting Congress about your displeasure, what the SEC is doing, has done, is really critical, because as I mentioned before, there will be a vote in Congress on reversing the SEC decision, and it will happen in 2018, probably around the summertime. So there's a number of months leading up to this point. If Congress is successful, and if President Trump is convinced that this is just too hot to handle, too many of the American people oppose what one of his federal agencies has done, you know, at the end of the day, he has to decide where he wants to be, you know, as a politician. And I feel very confident that we have a very super majority of both conservative and liberal voters on this issue. So if Congress votes it through and the president signs it, that's it. It's just the FCC's decision is reversed and things are restored back the way they were. In the absence of federal action in the short term, in terms of 2018, then I think supporting your municipality and your state legislator looking into this issue and doing what they can with local and state power is the natural next step until the day in the future where we can restore this at a federal level.
Do you imagine this will be a pivotal piece in the 2018 elections for, you know, people either voting for or against certain people up for re-election?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. I've been here for a number of these big internet moments, right? And like the biggest ones, like SOPA, is what people remember, the Stop Online Piracy Act. The volume of phone calls to Congress matches that metric or passes it. We're talking about more than 500,000 to 1 million people have called Congress in the last 2 or 3 weeks since the SEC issued its draft order before Thanksgiving. That's a massive number. And the polling showing about 83% and opposed to the SEC is just politically unsustainable. What you're going to see from Republicans, particularly who support the SEC's decision, is that they're going to try to co-opt the language of net neutrality and say, well, here's our net neutrality proposal. But it won't be anything back to what we generally expect from a non-discriminatory network. But they have to, because they know most people expect and like the idea and concept of net neutrality.
Yeah. Ernesto Falcon with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Really appreciate it when you guys take the time to come on the show. We love the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ernesto.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care and have a great night. All right. We got an email. James writes in to say, my boobtube greeted me with a rather rude YouTube message today. I do most of my YouTubing via the app on my Amazon Fire TV. It's back to the desktop computer starting at the beginning of the year. And that's because basically got a notice. And I think this happened earlier this year where we know that the Amazon Fire the Echo Show no longer allows for YouTube. I didn't realize that also applies to the Fire TV stick. So basically, if you have a Fire TV stick, as of the beginning of the year, YouTube's not going to work on it. So you're going to have to find another way to do it. This is a copy of the message, right?
Mm-hmm.
Starting on January 1st, 2018, the YouTube app will not be available on this device, though you can continue to enjoy your favorite creators and videos in many other ways. No one wants to do that in many other ways. They have the way to do it. It's really unfortunate that it comes down to this.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there are small problems when you're looking at the big picture, but it's annoying. I mean, it's annoying. Now, finally, we've got Amazon Prime app on the Apple TV. You know, one day I have YouTube on my Echo Show, the next day I don't. You know, it's frustrating, but also I wanted to read this email because I just love that James still calls it the boob tube.
Yeah. Yeah. Haven't seen that one in a while. At first I had to do a double take. I was like, what? Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's what we called the TV back in the day.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
What do Equifax, the HomePod, and the Juicero all have in common? They made Tom's Guide's list of best tech fails of 2017. Mark Spoonhauer, the editor-in-chief at Tom's Guide, is here to walk us through why these three and 14 others made the list. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So obviously the $700 juicer that works as good as our own hands failed in a different sort of way that the HomePod, which we have yet to have in our own hands, failed. Tell us what all of these companies on your list have in common.
Sure. So we tried to look at products that had a fair amount of hype behind them, because you can't really say something flops or is a fail if no one really cares to begin with. So this is actually one of the most fun stories that we do all year, where we have all the editors and writers sit in a room. And we have nominations. almost like awards, but in the worst kind of way. And what was interesting about this year's list is that there was one company that actually popped more than any of the others, and that was actually Google. And it came through multiple products, which raises serious questions, I think mostly about their quality control when it comes to hardware.
Yeah, a lot of people had multiple failures on this list. Google, Facebook was on the list twice. Talk about Facebook's fails this year, or their biggest fails.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the biggest one overall. I mean, certainly in terms of just like a serious note, I think the fact that they were caught discriminating against, or allowing advertisers to racially discriminate in their housing ads. And the fact that that sort of discrimination is still going on today, based on some of the reporting that ProPublica has done, landed them on our list. But I think in terms of the pure tone deaf award, the fact that you had Mark Zuckerberg out there streaming virtual or VR footage of himself, touring, which was basically a storm ravaged Puerto Rico. It was just amazing that that even happened to begin with. Like, who greenlighted that?
Yeah. Absolutely agree. Now, you have Twitter on the list for its Nazi problem, as you put it in the list. But I almost feel like this is a broader failure of social media in 2017 than just Twitter. All these challenges dealing with how they determine what is acceptable policing of their platforms, especially in light of forces like outright racism and that sort of thing. What do you think about that? Is it even bigger than Twitter, or is there something specific about Twitter's involvement that made it the one as the shining example here?
Yeah, it's not that we don't think that it is a broader issue, but there is something about continuing to grant what is very coveted verifications to what we consider to be Twitter's some of their most hateful users, right? Mm-hmm. So should that really be reserved? It's almost like an honor that you're bestowing an honor on someone who's spewing hate. So we definitely understand that the conundrum that Twitter is in terms of balancing, free speech without like harming all of their other users and what they should be exposed to. But we don't really feel like they've found the right balance yet.
Mm-hmm. So the Essential Phone and the Pixel XL, the new Pixel XL, both made the list.
What are you talking? You saying bad things about my Pixel?
I have heard lots of people who like both of these phones. This guy, for example. What do you say to that?
So, yeah, as far as the Pixel goes, it's not the fact that it's going to sound like a little bit of a contradiction, but it is on our list of best phones you can buy, period. But we were forced to change our rating from what was a glowing 9 out of 10 to 8 out of 10 because of all the quality control issues that they had out of the gate. The fact that, so they had the screen quality issues in terms of just some people complaining about the fact that you didn't really have OLED like colors and the narrow viewing angles and things like that. But then you also had burn-in, which is something they were able to address in a software update. But the fact that you're actually shipping phones out there, and this was reported and it seems to be true, that we're shipping to users without an operating system. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand like how something like that happened. So in my write-up of this, I really called Google out in terms of like, are you testing your phones before you're sending them out? And I just don't feel like consumers should be treated as beta testers. Like, if you want to be that close to iPhone in terms of like their launch and making sure that you're not getting overshadowed by the iPhone 10, I get that. But if there's anything that we learned from the Galaxy Note 7 launch, is that you should not rush your product to market.
Yeah, it really does feel like Google is still kind of learning how to do this hardware thing. Last year was a good launch of the Pixel line. This year, there were a lot of stumbling blocks between the Pixel. My Pixel Book, for example, just up a week ago, just stopped charging. It doesn't charge anymore. I have to get that traded in. And then, of course, the Google Home Mini, which you also kind of put in there as an example because of the phantom touches that ended up resulting in all of this audio, being streamed up to Google servers. If it were one of those things that happened, it wouldn't be a big deal. But because it crosses all of their product lines, it really does feel like they've got a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, I think one of the questions that we started to ask internally is, how important is it for Google to be in the hardware business, period, right? So I think you could make the case that when it comes to smart speakers, they are a very solid number two. And there's no one else who's really close to them because like their Cortana stuff is not taking off. There's a rumor that Samsung's working on a smart speaker, and I guess it'll be powered by Bixby. But so I understand with smart speakers because they're trying to establish an ecosystem. But when it comes to Android, I mean, there's certainly other companies that could do pure Android phones and have in the past. that, you know, with the Nexus line. So I'm not really sure what they're trying to accomplish with the Pixel line, although they are doing some great things with photography in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So the Juicero, this was, of course, the $800 juicer that was too expensive to begin with. But then, you know, they found out that you could just squeeze the bags of juice or bags of fruit. And do you think this was, I mean, this was an obvious fail, but do you think this was a turning point? Do you think people really woke up and said, hey, the Internet of Things is insane. Let's change what we're doing.
Yeah, I don't think we've reached that tipping point yet, because apparently at CES 2018, and we're getting a lot of pitches for awards and nominations. And I think you guys would be surprised about like some of the things that companies believe are innovative. And I'll just give you one example. So like the ability to, let's say, set the exact temperature for the shower that you're about to take, and then literally get an alert on your phone when your shower is ready at the right temperature. So like what are you doing in those like 10 to 20 seconds, let's say a minute, between the time you turn the water on until it's at the perfect temperature? I mean, I just don't even know what to say when I see stuff like that.
Did you get the one for asking whether you like to talk to your water bottle?
I did not.
Okay,
did
well,
not
I'll that. Forward it to you. Yeah. What if you wanted to talk to your water bottle was the pitch. And I emailed them back saying, like, do people want this? And weirdly, I got no response to the email, but then I got another pitch from the same guy.
Oh, no. Now you're on an even broader pitch list.
And I won't. I know. I won't say what it is, but check it out. You can talk to your water bottle.
So, I do think innovation is alive and well, but I think companies that are actually trying to solve real world problems as opposed to sort of making them up, I feel like that's the dividing line, right? Like, is it a real problem that you're trying to solve, or does it make your life like infinitesimally a little bit more convenient?
Yeah, or not, because it always sounds like it's going to make it more convenient, but then it turns into an entirely different type of complication. Uber was, of course, on your list, and I think it deserved to be there for a very, you know, for far too many reasons, right? One of the failiest companies this year by far. Have they made enough changes to begin to turn that around? In other words, when you do this again in 2018, do you have confidence that Uber won't make the list again based on some of those changes?
Well, I think if you take a step back, in a way, it almost doesn't matter, because when you talk to people, they're like, I've asked people who are sort of Uber enthusiasts, and I said, like, would you go to an alternative? And they said, probably not, just because like Lyft does a good job, but I guess they just don't necessarily have the penetration that Uber does. But I do think they definitely have to make strides in the coming year. Like the fact, like you guys probably saw in recent days, that someone got hit with an $18,000 bill.
From Uber?
Right. Yeah. So they got hit with that bill. And then it was only once they actually went to social media and had other people talking about it that they were able to get that reversed. And Uber came out and apologized. But in the initial back and forth between this customer and Uber, they said, oh, no, that's accurate. So I think they definitely have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
So I was wondering why none of the disgraced venture capitalists made your list, like Justin Kalbeck, for example.
That's a good point. Like, we tried to stay out of like personalities and tried to focus more on companies and products. But that's a good point that you bring up, because when we were talking about the Essential phone, you could make the case that one of the other reasons that they're a fail is that, you know, the head of the company had to take a leave of absence, which is the new term for sort of, you know, walking away briefly in shame before deciding whether or not it's okay to come back.
But it was okay for him to come back.
Yeah, I actually don't know. Is he back in charge right now?
I think he is back in charge. Andy Rubin.
Andy Rubin. Yeah, he came back. Yes, yeah. But we don't actually know what that was actually about. We just know that there was a thing that happened.
Right, and I tend to assume if we didn't hear about it, it wasn't anything. But that's probably wrong to assume.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I think in that particular case, we mostly focused on the reports about how many phones have been sold, and I think, you know, when your exclusive is with Sprint, which is basically the worst performing carrier, I think, and the fact that they had to reduce the price of the phone to get people more excited about it, it's a shame, because it wasn't a terrible piece of hardware, but I, again, going back to quality control, when I first tested the phone, you know, the camera was really slow, where I literally counted the seconds between snapping the shutter and seeing the photo show up in my photo gallery. And they improved that in terms of updates after that. But you only have, you know, one chance to make a good first impression, right? Especially when you're a smaller company. And I think they blew it in this case.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Mark Spoonhauer is the editor-in-chief at Tom's Guide, where you can also find a brand new published piece on the five freedoms that you just lost with the end of net neutrality. So check that out at Tom's Guide. Thank you so much for coming on, Mark.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.
Kids these days, they will do anything to get ahead in Minecraft, including taking down the entire internet. Find out how they did it after the break. But first, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more efficiently. No matter if it's a text or a resume, your writing looks polished and professional. Did you know that passive voice is hated by me, Jason?
I did know that, actually. I still don't know entirely when I'm using passive voice.
I know. But you do know that it is hated by me.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah. And passive voice was just used by me in that sentence. He's always learning. I use Grammarly. Jason uses Grammarly. You can cut and paste any English text into Grammarly's online text editor or use it like I do by installing Grammarly's free browser extension for Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting some style improvements. Grammarly scans your text for common and complex grammatical mistakes like subject-verb agreement, modifier placement, comma splice, weak adjectives, no one likes a weak adjective, missing articles, and more. Grammarly's powerful algorithms are developed by the world's leading linguists and language lovers. Improve your skills with Grammarly's detailed explanations for all your mistakes and weekly progress reports. Write confidently and mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Be sure also to check out Grammarly's Facebook and Twitter accounts for fun grammar tips and discussions. The Grammarly blog also offers daily tips and insights on how to improve your day-to-day writing to achieve personal and professional goals. Get started and join more than 10 million happy Grammarly Chrome users today. Download Grammarly now for free at getgrammarly.com/twit. That's getgrammarly.com/twit. And we thank Grammarly for their support.
We talk a lot about the insecurities that plague our ever-growing world of Internet of Things and connected devices like security cameras, for one. In August of 2016, the Mirai botnet commandeered hundreds of thousands of these devices for financial gain and fraud, ultimately. Three men have now pleaded guilty to charges, at least that has been revealed in the last few days, that say they created the code that created that massive botnet. And joining us to help lay the groundwork for how and why it all happened is Ian Scher, executive editor at CNET. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Awesome. It's great to have you back, sir. So first of all, the three men weren't explicitly responsible for carrying out the attacks last August, but basically for their interest in attacking Minecraft servers, at least initially. Talk a little bit about why exactly these men created this botnet in the first place.
Yeah, it's really funny. So they created this, as you mentioned, to attack Minecraft, of all things. And what they'd done is that they were seeking out vulnerabilities that existed in all these devices that we have. So we're talking about like the smart camera in your home, all sorts of stuff. It's not just a computer or a phone. And so they were able to build this, what we call a botnet, a bunch of machines that basically been taken over. And it became one of the largest out there. It's funny, there's actually a quote in one of the stories out there about it, that it was like the Manhattan Project. They didn't even realize what they had on their hands. And so what happened was that eventually it was sold and then commandeered and was turned into this thing that helped to take down the internet for a day. But they never intended to do that. They were just trying to make trouble on Minecraft.
So their initial intention was to make trouble in Minecraft. But I mean, ultimately, one of the men involved, Shaw, later, like you said, sold that botnet code to cyber criminals and then later made that code open source. So there was a little bit of an intention there to spread it out there. Was this a protection maneuver on their part? Were they trying to kind of cover their tracks at some point?
It's hard to tell, right? I think that at some point, I can't reach into their heads,
right,
I think at some point The interesting thing here, and actually Wired, I have to give them credit, even though they're not CNET, that they did an incredible job picking through the story. And one of the interesting things is that there's this whole like mafia underworld that these three men got involved in. And that's really where it gets interesting, is that this kind of protection racket slash how do we attack different websites thing really became a part of this story. And so that's where it gets a little murky. But, you know, you could say probably maybe he was trying to cover up his tracks. Maybe he didn't realize what he had on his hands. It's a kind of a mix of a lot of stuff, I think.
Yeah.
So Brian Krebs, the security researcher of Krebs on Security, got taken down by this. Did they target him in particularly? And did they target him because he was on their case? I mean, because they eventually after this did reveal who they were.
Right. So he did. He was targeted. And actually, what's interesting to me is that him being targeted was what got the FBI involved. Mm. You know, they were kind of aware of it, but it really brought the whole thing to the front burner for them. And that again is because it was one of, I think it was one of the largest attacks that, when he was attacked, was one of the largest attacks that Akamai had ever seen. And to think that these, you know, three basically college students, again, Minecraft players, could create such a devastating botnet is rather amazing. And, you know, they're pretty young, too, right? And they were able to cause so much trouble. So that's ultimately what led to their downfall, was Krebs being attacked.
Yeah, so obviously, and then Krebs was able to out them, or at least, you know, follow the breadcrumb trail in January to name them. And that seems to be part of what led to all this happening. One thing that I found interesting in all of this is this DDoS mitigation service that they were apparently running. It was like a one-stop shop. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, I think this is where the really tough parts of the internet come in, right? Is that, you know, you think of companies like Facebook and Twitter, they've got enough money to build their own protection services to stop hackers and whatnot. And by the way, they're attacked every second of every day. It's unbelievable. But for those of us like, you know, normal people like myself, you know, if I have a little dinky website and I'm trying to build it into something, I can't afford that type of stuff. And so there are people out there where I've seen this. Hackers do this a lot now. They'll attack a website and then they'll say, hey, we found a vulnerability, but you're going to have to pay us to fix it. And it kind of turns into this kind of very weird, you know, hey, you've got a nice storefront there. It would be a sad thing if something happened to it, right? And this is kind of what they became a part of. And it's really sad because it's one of the nastier parts of the internet. And it's one of these things that we get to see kind of a view into through this case.
Mm-hmm. So the criminals were paid for a lot of these services with Bitcoin. And then part of their punishment is to turn over this Bitcoin. When, what's the government then going to do to this with this Bitcoin? Just hold on to it and hope they remember the password to their Bitcoin wallet?
Yeah, and that the value grows and maybe we can pay off our debt on it. Yes, yes. Exactly. That would be amazing, by the way. So what happens typically is that when the government gets restitution from this type of stuff, it tends to go into a fund that then helps to either continue fighting these cases or also the general fund and stuff. So, you know, with Bitcoin, it's been interesting because I don't know if you remember during the Silk Road case, there were actually a couple of agents who ended up trying to steal Bitcoin out of the ones that were taken from the bad guy in that case. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But generally, you know, it's like any other money that they take away and property, right? It kind of goes into the general government, you know, ether, and then it comes out a different way.
Yeah. For some reason, though, right now at this moment in time, knowing that Bitcoin is part of this transaction or part of the penalty makes it sting even that much more. another part of the plea deal involves Zsa's attack on the Rutgers University network using the Mirai botnet. Was this about like, you know, altering grades? Because he was a student at the time, right? What do we know about that?
So honestly, not that much. We know that he made these attacks. But I mean, I think it's very similar to what he was doing with Minecraft and everything. Yeah. These are kids who were just playing around, right? And, you know, they're trying to test as much as they could. And I see this all the time. I remember when, you know, the hacking thing started really grabbing attention a couple of years ago. These kids were just, you know, they're having fun. And that's part of what's interesting is that this hacking for kicks thing has been around for quite a while. Yeah, they've found ways to make money off it too, and that's pretty scummy. But it's part of that culture of the hacking world, right? Is to get see how far you can get and what you can get away with. And by the way, it's worth pointing out, even Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple, he hacked the phone lines and was able to get the Pope on the phone at one point. So this is a long running history here.
Sure.
So the way they part of how they did this, the vulnerabilities were in IoT devices. They just scanned. Yeah. It was very simple what they did, actually. I mean, they were smart, but what they did was pretty simple. They scanned for default security passwords on IoT devices because many people don't change them, and many devices make it very difficult to even know how to change them now. Right. Is that changing at all, or is it getting these companies that are producing these IoT devices making it easier for us to protect them on our end?
Well, these companies are definitely getting shamed about it. There's one website I remember very fondly called Insicam. I don't know if you remember this, but it was a website that you could literally go to and see. It was short for insecure camera. You could see into people's homes. And I literally was like clicking around, and I was suddenly in someone's penthouse in New York, and then I was in Hong Kong. It was scary because you never knew idea like what you were going to see. And I was afraid for the people on the other end of that camera. But it was a way to underscore how these default passwords are so dangerous. And so, yes, this is something that the industry is becoming more aware of. I think still, if you take it as a whole, it's a big problem, especially outside the United States. But, you know, the industry does seem to notice that there is a problem. And I'll point out, it's not just these cameras and stuff. I mean, this happened in this case. But one of my favorite examples also is the Hello Barbie. Right. Yeah. You remember that from, right? I mean, that thing was hackable, and suddenly you had like these dirty, rotten men talking to children through their Barbie. I mean, come on. Right. And so it's really a sign that it's not just the tech industry. Anyone who makes anything connected to the internet needs to be responsible about it. And that's really hard because connecting stuff to the internet is super easy, but being thoughtful about it is very hard.
Yeah, big change is happening. Hopefully in 2018, we'll have a different story to talk about. Ian Scher from CNET.com, really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about this today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, find him on CNET.com. We'll talk to you later, Ian. All right, up next, we take a look at the state of tech accessibility in 2017. Things have come a long way, I would argue. We're going to talk all about that. But first, a message from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system that's actually designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper actually works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase. You already have the phone. You already have the hardware. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone that you already have. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client is going to see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. So your phone kind of serves dual purposes in that regard. Simply select a toll-free or local number. You record a custom greeting. You can add multiple extensions for your business. You can also use toll-free numbers, which are great for marketing. It makes your business sound even more professional. You set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. You can get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments if that's easier for you. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number on your device. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 per month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So now you can turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. And we thank Grasshopper for their support of Tech News Weekly.
We hear from a lot of you, and we're always grateful for that. We are particularly grateful to one listener, Kevin, who is One-Armed Geek on Twitter, for recommending that we talk to our next guest, Deborah Rue, a tech inclusion and accessibility expert, podcaster, blogger, author, and CEO. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Thank you so much, Megan. And thank you for Steve for recommending me on the show. I've been watching the show for years, so I'm very excited.
Well, I would love to tell you, to ask you all the things we've gotten wrong over the years, but I won't. I'll ask you that offline. There's a quote from you that I really love that I assume is from your book. You say, "The only disability is when people cannot see human potential." When I read that, I knew I had to talk to you about how tech is doing in terms of that quote, especially this year. So can you talk a little bit about some of the biggest advancements in tech inclusion and accessibility that you've seen this year?
Yes, Megan, I'm very excited about what we're seeing. I think a lot of this technology that's happening, the VR, the AI, the robotics, the driverless cars, all of those are, I believe, have the power to change our lives, but certainly really have the power to make sure that people with disabilities are being included in society. These things are also tying with medical advancements that are allowing us to live longer. And I often say on my program, Human Potential at Work, that having a disability is just a very normal part of the human experience. I think sometimes we forget that, but it is. A lot of people, some people with disabilities are born with disabilities, like my daughter with Down syndrome, but most people with disabilities acquire the disabilities as they live their lives. And as we get over the age of 65, according to AARP, about 46% of us acquire disabilities. So it's just part of the human experience, and technology is going to help that.
Obviously, when we talk about accessibility, there's a number of different facets of technology where that can fit in, be it the services we use or the hardware that we use. In the case of personal technology devices like our smartphones and tablets and that sort of stuff, are we in a better place now in terms of accessibility than we were 5 years ago? I know I've seen, from my brain that isn't very tied in directly to that world, I see changes, but I don't know the effectiveness. Are they solving the right problems? How are they doing?
Well, and that's a great question, Jason. And I actually think they are solving the right problems. It's interesting, if we go back a few years, I remember we were told that that we could not take our tablets and our touchscreens, mainly our touchscreens, and make them accessible to people that were blind. It was just impossible. And then Apple did it. So I guess they figured out the impossible. So, and they have the voiceover on their smartphones, and Apple now has some of the most accessible phones in the world, and a large number of them are people with disabilities because, of course, we're going to use something that's accessible to us. So I'm very hopeful about the future. I think the technologists, the innovators, people that are trying to do social good, all understand that there's value in all of us being included. And the good news about accessibility is that when you make technology or applications or anything accessible, it makes it more accessible and usable for all customers and consumers, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm. So we're pretty hard on Facebook around here, but what have they done this year to make their service more accessible to all?
Well, Facebook's done a really good job. And all of the social media platforms, I think, are doing a good job. Twitter's doing a good job. Some of them are further ahead than others, but Facebook has done quite a bit making sure that we can make our videos accessible. And just something that I thought was interesting, I've seen different numbers depending on where you're looking, but we've heard that between 80 and 85% of the videos that are watched on Facebook are watched without the sound. Mm-hmm. So think about that. You're spending a lot of time to make that video and getting us to watch it, and we're watching it without the sound. So you really need to make sure you're telling your story in a way that if we're not listening to it, that we can still get your message. And at the same time, that really supports people that, that people that are deaf, people that are hard of hearing. So once again, when we do it right, society benefits.
Yeah,
so
a lot.
Facebook actually doing a good job. No, excuse me, Jason. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to touch on that. That's been one feature that I've seen, especially over the last couple of years. I've benefited from that, because a lot of times I'm scrolling on my phone. The last thing I really want is to turn up the audio and to watch a video for 5 minutes. So, but because that text is there, and I think a lot of times it's automatically generated, so that the systems behind the scenes are making it easier and easier to do that. Everybody seems to benefit. I can only imagine how beneficial that is to someone who is hearing impaired, or that just opens up that world even more. That's a really good example of what you're talking about.
Yes. And another example, when you look at things like captioning or text-to-speech and things like that, this was created for people with disabilities. And yet we all use captioning when we're in a crowded restaurant or at the gym or in a fast food restaurant, and we cannot hear the volume of the television, but they are showing captions or information running across the screen, we can participate even if we can't hear it. So once again, think of the value certainly to people that can't hear or have dramatic hearing loss or are deaf, but benefit to all of society, which to me is a win.
Absolutely.
So I know that Facebook has gotten better about metadata. When people post photos, they're using AI to be able to, you know, so people using screen readers can see what the images are. What about Twitter? Like if I post, I'm always posting screenshots or photos, just, you know, just uploading them. I'm not taking the time to add metadata as I would or used to when I was making a blog. Are those accessible to people using screen readers?
They can be accessible because Twitter last year, I believe, they made it possible so that we can tag these videos. And what I do, because I try to be conscious of it, is I'm very visual. So I'm posting things visually all the time, but I take the time to make sure that it's tagged right. And I also provide a description. And once again, benefits people that are using screen readers so they can't see the video, I mean, the graphics, but it winds up benefiting everybody. And of course, when you do it on the internet, it increases your search engine optimization results. So there's benefits beyond making things accessible to all of us. It's also pulling you up higher in the ranking, which is exciting.
There's been a thread the past few years that's really been very strong. We talked about it on this show a lot around inclusion in technology inside the companies that create a lot of this technology and gaining perspective from all people from all different walks of life, from all different experiences and everything. How are there enough voices within the tech bubble, let's say, that carry the perspective of those who rely on accessibility features, or many times are these features being created by people who think they know what needs to be done without having that extra level of communication from that side?
That's another great question, Jason. And I'll tell you, at first, no, it was not at all. People were just, I remember when I got in this industry in early 2000, I heard many people say, just close your eyes and pretend like you're blind. Well, there's a whole lot more to design than that. But I still think there are not enough people with disabilities that are included in design and this technology and solving these problems. But we really have seen some very, very interesting designers. I had the pleasure to interview August, who is the head of Pinterest design and also the head designer for Xbox. And he is a person with physical disabilities. And he really brings such a unique perspective to the design of anything, especially something like Pinterest that is all pictorial. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing more and more. We see, for example, Microsoft Chief Accessibility Officer Jenny Leigh Fleury is a person that is profoundly deaf. So I think some of the really smart brands are realizing bringing in more diversity, which of course includes, women and all the others, LGBT and all that, but also includes people with disabilities. We're starting to see some interesting trends, including companies hiring very specifically, reaching out to hire technologists with autism, which is SAP has done that. Microsoft has done that. There's a ton of companies that are starting to do that and really join these conversations. And so I'm hopeful. I think we've had small mini tipping points, but there's still a lot of work to do to make sure that we're fully integrated and that the people that are, you're trying to make sure that a product or technology is designed for actually can join the conversation and add value and innovation to it.
What about the podcast industry? I mean, how is anyone making podcasts more accessible with people with hearing, people who are deaf?
Yes, the podcast, it's very exciting what's happening with podcasts because there's so many different ways, as y'all know, that you can present this data. So the data can be presented so that if a person has lost a sense or, they can't hear, they can't see, or they can't click a mouse, there's a lot of different options. And I am a podcaster. So what I do is sometimes I do my shows on Facebook Live, And so we caption those videos, and it's gotten much more, much less expensive to caption things. And when I do my podcast, I always include a transcription with it, which some of my viewers, even if they don't need that accessibility, prefer. And I will give a shout out to the company I use. It's RevRev.com, which somebody told me about it. My producer, Doug Foresta, told me about it. And it's really, really inexpensive, but the quality is very high. So there's ways that you can make podcasts fully accessible, and more people with disabilities are also becoming podcasters, which is exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot of voices in podcasts now, more and more every single day. What would you say is the biggest misconception, misunderstanding when it comes to, you know, and as I imagine from the perspective of the person who does not have an accessibility necessity, what's the biggest misunderstanding that usually falls upon those people about what someone who needs these features really needs?
Well, I think, like you said before, Jason, there was a lot of guessing going on before. I remember some of the clients that I worked with in the past with my former company, Tech Access. They were so good-hearted, and they meant so well. And they're like, oh, we did this and we spent all this money. And then they realized that, you know, the people they were trying to design this for, it did not work for at all. And so I think it goes back to humanizing technology, making sure that you're designing for people, and that the people that you're designing for, that you're making sure that you're actually involving those communities so they can help you be successful. But I think there's that, first of all, is one of the biggest one. And another one is deciding that people are not capable of using this technology or these devices. That was, I had that a lot. I heard it a lot more back in 2000s and stuff, where, well, do we hire people that are blind? Do people that are blind use the internet? And ridiculous comments like that. We don't hear that as much anymore. But I think forgetting to make sure the people that you're designing for are part of, you know, the design team, and making sure you're including them in some way so that they can tell you, you know, how to do it. And I'll give you a quick example. There was a woman that complained that the bus was not accessible to her. The bus schedules weren't accessible. So a very well-meaning bus company in one of our states went out and made their bus schedule Braille. Okay, well, a bus schedule sometimes changes, like hourly. Mm-hmm. So if you made it Braille, which a lot of people that are blind don't read Braille anyway, it doesn't do you any good, because now you have a static product that's shifting and changing. And that's almost more frustrating to say, go use that Braille menu when it's not up to date. All they had to do was make sure that their bus schedules were accessible using a Word document, and this was years ago, but that's a good example of wasting money, because you don't really understand what the community needs for your product to be accessible.
What about those companies that over the last few years have really been the ones disrupting different economies, like Airbnb and Uber? How did they do this year in terms of accessibility?
Well, Uber, as you know, has gotten, I don't know as much about Airbnb. I'm not hearing as much about what they're doing, but Uber has been in the news a lot, making a lot of, bad decisions and mistakes. But they actually have done some really cool things to make sure that people with disabilities are able to participate in Uber. They're able to work for Uber. And they have a really cool program they've done where they're recruiting drivers that are deaf, and they've updated their application so that whenever the you flag a ride and the ride happens to be somebody that has a deaf driver, they say, don't call the driver, text them. And then they're finding that this expanded part of the app, that many of the customers are preferring to use that over the regular. I mean, it's all the same app, but you can turn on these accessibility features. And so instead of your phone calling, you know, the driver calling you, it flashes at you and it, you know, it gives you, it vibrates and stuff. And in a crowded situation where sometimes I can't hear, my phone is ringing, I find that that's more accessible to me, the person that doesn't have a hearing or a hearing loss, and I'm not deaf. So they're finding that they create something for one segment and then everybody else starts using it, which is exciting.
I know you talk a lot about how accessibility can be profitable also. And I brought up Airbnb because I know they recently purchased a company called Accommable. I think that's how you pronounce it. They're known as the Airbnb for disabled people. So, you know, I'm sure they paid a lot of money for them too. So that's one way, I guess, companies are doing it. Instead of trying to do it in-house, they'll buy a successful business that's already devoted to that.
And that's a good point, Megan, because you don't have to recreate the wheel, because there's a lot of entrepreneurs in the disability field, and they've created some very innovative products. And I'll tell you, as far as individuals with disabilities, many more of them are entrepreneurs. And the part of the reason why was because people with disabilities were not getting hired, especially if they have a physical disability that can be seen. They weren't getting hired in the traditional workforce. And so they became entrepreneurs because, you know, they had no choice. They wanted to contribute. They wanted to pay their bills. So we're seeing a lot of innovation coming from the community of people with disabilities all over the world, too. Very exciting. I'm just very hopeful about the future, because I think it all works better when everyone can be included, regardless of their abilities or loss of a sense or something like that.
Deborah, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you will come back, because I have a lot more questions that I haven't gotten to.
I would be so honored, Megan, and thank you so much for everything you're doing. I love technology, and as we talked a little bit, Megan, it is all about social good and inclusion for all, too. So thank you all so much for the work that you do.
Oh, thank you. Well, Deborah Rue is a social media expert. She is all over everywhere on social media. So where's the best place? If you had to give people one place to follow you where they can get everything, where would they go?
Well, I happen to love Twitter, and so I have a lot of followers on Twitter. So I'm at Deborah Rue, but I'm also on all of the other channels, too. I love Facebook. I use them all for different reasons. You know, I sort of build upon. I start on Twitter and then build upon it on Facebook and LinkedIn and Pinterest and Instagram. I love social media.
So anyone who's just listening to this is Deborah Rue, R-U-H. So that's how you spell it. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Happy holidays.
You too.
All right, you too. And finally, if all you've ever wanted is to create your very own version of the dancing hot dog, well, now you can. Snap released an app for Mac and for Windows computers that allows users to create their own lenses for Snapchat to bring their own fantastic AR characters, whatnot, into the social media world. Now, users, and probably more importantly to Snap, advertisers will get to work on scripting their own dancing things or not dancing things. They'll be limited to creating world lenses for now, which uses the rear-facing camera for starters. A limited list of advertisers have been given the chance to start building face filters, but at some point, supposedly, that could open up to general users as well. And you can get started. Lens Studio, it makes like a little snap code. That code will last for a year. So when you make one and you bring it into Snapchat, you can post with it. Your friends can you can share it with your friends and give your friends access to your own homemade filters.
So you know well that I am a huge fan of Snapchat.
Mm-hmm. Or the filters, anyways.
Filters, yeah. I don't actually communicate with it. But I downloaded the studio, and then I quickly realized that it would require some knowledge of 3D modeling, which okay. I don't yet have.
Perhaps you and Padre need to get in cahoots on this.
Well, Anthony already made one.
Oh,
and
really?
He sent it to me privately, and I don't know if I can reveal it or not. But the link's in there, Josh, so click on it.
So we're doing it anyways. I don't know if we have permission to do it, but dang
so
it, we're doing it anyways.
He made a Twit Studio overlay type thing. So there it is. And I guess we'll make it available if we still can. He's probably so, I mean, he just did it like in the last, I don't know, day. So
obviously we can't actually see the filter until we use our phones with Snapchat
on
this thing.
If he'll let us, maybe we'll put that in. And so you'll have to download the show and then you can see it there. We'll put it in later. And then if he comes in here with a baseball bat with a bunch of nails in it saying, that was just between you and me, then
this is an Anthony I've never known before.
It's a Stranger Things reference. I'm sorry.
Does he also have a Lego? Or what is it, an Ego? Lego? Yeah.
A bag of Legos? He might instead get an Ego and hit me over the head with it. That would probably, I don't think he would actually do the nails.
I don't think Anthony's violent. I think we're all going to be okay. Get the filter. Let us know how it goes. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show. I know I say it every week. I'm going to say it again. twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe. And if you like what you hear, then tell your friends about it. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney. And I really, like, honestly, Deborah came completely through a conversation that I had through Twitter. I try to read all my DMs. I want to hear from you guys and ideas that you have for the show, things you like, things you don't like. We're obviously not going to be able to do everything that you like. But you can't please everyone. That's what my mom always said.
It's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. But we'll try. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. By the way, if you ever want to come into the studio to watch our live shows, you can email tickets@twit.tv. Make sure and email us first and let us know that you're coming. We'll leave a chair out for you. We'll even put a chair out for you. That's how much we love you. Thanks to Alex. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Jammer B, who was in here, and Burke, who left. I'm sure he had something more important to do. And thanks to you for checking out Tech News Weekly. And we'll see y'all next week. Have a great weekend. Bye, everybody.